listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson.
And I'm Kate Archer Kent. Coming up, we'll hear from a reporter about the Wisconsin Herd NBA development team and the decision to make Oshkosh their home.
First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. This week in Washington, Senate Republicans dropped another attempt to replace the Affordable Care Act. But U.S. Senator Ron Johnson from Wisconsin says he's not giving up.
Senator Johnson has been a vocal critic of the way the bill has been handled and of Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who's worked to try to get a health care law passed.
Robert Menser joins us now to talk about the Wisconsin angle of this national story and to round up other top stories from around the state. He's a senior statewide editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back to Central Time.
Hello, thank you.
So there were a lot of developments on the national health care front this week. Can you tell us more about what role Senator Ron Johnson played in those stories?
Yeah, so Senator Johnson has been a key player in this sort of drama of the Republican health care bill, which is dead and then revived and dead, and maybe there's going to be a vote next week, but the sort of back and forth. In a sort of unexpected way, Johnson, who is a very conservative Republican senator and a harsh critic of Obamacare, from the point before the Congress's July 4th recess, he was sharply critical of the Republican leadership's process for writing the bill. He said it was rushed and closed, which, I mean, it was. He was one of the key senators who criticized that process and forced a delay until after the recess. And he's continued to critique the bill from the right, saying that it didn't do enough to remove policies and regulations from Obamacare. And then earlier this week, Johnson actually confirmed and then issued a press release statement accusing Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell of playing both sides of the fence on the bill's Medicaid cuts. He said that he had talked with multiple sources and that McConnell had been telling moderate Republican senators not to worry about these Medicaid cuts because they're way off in the future and they probably won't even happen. So Johnson called that a significant breach of trust and again was sort of has been on the outs with leadership on this.
And let's take a step back and look at the bigger picture here. Is Senator Johnson's career and where he's at now, does this fit into kind of the persona and the position that he's carved out for himself?
So, indeed, he ran, Johnson, of course, is a plastics magnate and was a businessman who first came to prominence in politics as part of the Tea Party movement, and he spoke out against Obamacare, and so, indeed, he was part of this group of legislators elected in 2010 who were, critical of the way the Republican Party had behaved and been run, and sort of saw themselves as being there to defy sort of politics as usual. On the other hand, then once he got into the Senate, he didn't do very much of that sort of Freedom Caucus, Hell No Caucus type of activity. He was more or less a team player for his first term. So that's one of the reasons why it's been somewhat unexpected, the sharpness of his critiques of this bill.
And certainly the national health care debate is nowhere near over. Do you anticipate that Senator Johnson will continue to be a major player as the saga continues?
Well, so we don't know what's going to happen. It is hard to see how the Republican repeal effort, repeal and replace, repeal and delay, the various menu of options that may be up for a vote next week, it's hard to see how those pass, and it's a little hard to imagine The sort of fundamental case here is that conservative senators like Ron Johnson won't vote for a bill that moderate Republican senators like those in Medicaid expansion states and so on would vote for. That's like a fundamental problem. I don't see how that gets solved. But weirder things have happened. I try not to make predictions because a lot of things can go on in these closed door meetings, and Republicans really seem to want to pass Obamacare repeal, but they just there's sort of no path for it.
Let's come back to state news here. And on Monday, Governor Scott Walker signed 11 bills to combat the opioid crisis. What are some of the things that are addressed in these bills?
Sure. So, yes, 11 bills, mostly sort of, relatively modest bills, new expenditures, but all of them together, aimed at addressing the opioid crisis. They're also, this is the third year that there have been a set of, bills that move the state in this direction. So some of what they would do, for instance, there's a $2 million boost to grants that encourage counties to divert offenders to treatment instead of sending them to jail. The state will create several regional opioid treatment centers. That's a total of $1 million investment. And there's another one that would make it so that school employees cannot be sued if they administer Narcan. That's the drug that can save the life of someone who's overdosing.
My understanding is that they have to be trained and so know how to use it, but then if they administer it and something goes wrong, they can't be sued.
Sure, right. Yeah, exactly. But, I mean, the training is... For instance, it's now standard practice for EMTs to receive this training, for police officers, fire departments in many cases have it. So, I mean, there's training, but I mean, it's not you give someone a shot, you know.
Mm-hmm. I found one of the aspects of this interesting because it wasn't something I realized before. Apparently, in some cases, not a lot, but in some cases, codeine, opium, and similar drugs could be acquired without a prescription, but now a prescription is needed across the board.
Right. Yes, it's probably the case that you're probably like me. A lot of people thought that that was already the law. It doesn't seem like when you go to the drugstore that there are a lot of codeine or opium cold medicines on the shelves. But yeah, this is sort of making sure that that's the case and sort of closing any remaining cases where people can get their hands on those drugs without a prescription.
There's also a charter school being established for students struggling with addiction. What do we know about that?
Yes. So again, this is interesting. It's on a relatively small scale. I think it's for 15 students. It would be fair to characterize it as sort of an experimental program. But it's also very interesting. You wonder a lot of times people who are young people who are dealing with addiction. They feel isolated from their peers, and it may be the case that in an environment where it's geared towards others who have had that same experience, that they may find some support there.
And Rob, I should tell people we're talking with Rob Menzer, senior statewide editor for the USA Today Network, Wisconsin, based in Wausau, wrapping up the week's news. Rob, in some business news, on Wednesday, Quick Trip Incorporated announced that they agreed to buy 34 PDQ convenience stores. Quick Trip, being a lacrosse company, grown a lot in the past few years. Is this a good announcement for Wisconsin's economy?
Yeah, Quick Trip is based in La Crosse, and yeah, it has been growing like crazy. So they have the franchise has added more than 200 stores since 2013 with this announcement. It puts them over 200 and employed something. I don't have it in front of me, but several thousand more people in the recent years. This is a growing franchise for sure. Where I live, it seems like they're close to the territory of Quick Trips opening inside other Quick Trips. It's like they're everywhere. But so now that's going to be true in Madison and in some Milwaukee suburbs as well. With this purchase, they're going to start to remodel these 30-some stores by sort of mid next year. Those are scheduled to be, if all goes well with the deal and it goes through and all, should be switched over to Quick Trips.
And I was surprised to learn that Quick Trip is actually one of the largest convenience store chains in the country.
Yeah. It's from La Crosse to the world.
And finally, Rob, an issue I know is near and dear to your heart. Wausau City Council vote Tuesday night means backyard chickens will now be allowed within Wausau City limits. How long has it taken to get that huge victory?
Finally. Wausau joins such cities as Madison. And Appleton, and yeah, backyard chickens. I was measuring my backyard for coop space. I don't know if my wife is listening to this. She hasn't fully bought into this process, but I think we can bring her around.
Well, was there much opposition to this?
Well, yeah. I think that the first thing that people, this has been true every place that debates backyard chickens, is people don't want roosters. Well, roosters aren't allowed, right? And that's the case with most urban chicken ordinances. You can own hens, you can't own roosters in the city limits because they annoy people who don't like to wake up early in the morning. So that's fair enough. But also, people are worried that chickens might be dirty or there's going to be chickens roaming the streets. I feel like it's the sort of thing that maybe, after it gets rolling, people will see that it didn't like really pull apart the fabric of society, but I could be wrong. Wausau passed this with a 1-year review, so in a year's time, they're going to decide whether or not the backyard chickens were a good idea or not.
So the chickens are basically on probation.
The chickens are on probation.
All right. Well, we will definitely keep following that story with your help, Rob Menser, senior statewide editor for the USA Today Network, Wisconsin and Wausau. Rob, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
The Milwaukee Bucks unveiled the name of their new development team recently. They'll be known as the Wisconsin Herd. Oshkosh was chosen from among a handful of cities to be home to the new team, and the city is already in the process of building a new arena to host their games.
Here now to fill us in on what this means for the city is Nate Beck. He's business reporter for the Oshkosh Northwestern. Nate, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
What exactly is this NBA D League team?
So basically, it's kind of a minor league offshoot of the Milwaukee Bucks. Differs a little bit from the MLB system in that Oshkosh's team is the sole minor league club of the Bucks. There's no kind of tiered system like you have in baseball, AAA, AA, and Single A ball. So. You'll see, I guess, players who are injured coming in, new recruits, folks like that will be playing games here in Oshkosh.
And I understand it's now being rebranded and renamed the G League or the Gatorade League. Is that right?
Right. Correct. That went into effect in June. It's kind of a, yeah. So the official title is the G League.
When will the Herd start playing games in Oshkosh? That's what we want to know.
Well, they're shooting for this fall, so the start of the NBA season in 2017. They're working quickly to complete the new arena on Oshkosh's south side, and they're aiming to be ready this season. So,
can they build an arena that fast?
They've done quite a bit here to try to move the process along. The arena kind of replaces this factory on the city's south side called the Buckstaff Factory, which had, a century-old property, was tied up in a lawsuit, and they've done quite a bit to, facilitate knocking that down. The city has, supported that development through tax incentives and whatnot. And now if you drive down South Main Street, you can see the frame of that going up, so.
And where do these players come from who will be playing on the Herd?
I guess they come from the draft. I guess sort of instead of going to the Bucks, I mean they'll sort of use the minor league team kind of as a vehicle for that.
Did they get paid? I would assume. What might they get paid? Salaries.
I don't know offhand how much they're getting paid, but yeah, they'll be compensated like a minor league player would.
So where did the Bucks go before the Herd? Where did they go for recruiting before this team?
They partnered with another D League outfit, and that's sort of what the league had done. Before this, the NBA kind of decided to, have each NBA team launch their own minor league affiliate. So the Bucks' decision to create the Herd is sort of falls within that context.
Is this a direct pipeline to the Bucks, or isn't it?
Correct.
Oh, it is. So all the players may end up on the Bucks, or just some, or.
Well, I mean, I think that's their call. It's, just like the Timber Rattlers in Appleton feed into the Brewers organization, the Herd in Oshkosh feeds into the Bucks.
And I understand you can be 18 to play in the G League. Will the NBA go younger than that and recruit high school kids one day?
I'm not sure about that.
That remains to be seen.
Right.
We're talking right now with Nate Beck about the Wisconsin Herd and what this means for Oshkosh. Nate Beck is a business reporter for the Oshkosh Northwestern, and the Milwaukee Bucks unveiled the name of their new development team recently, and it is the Wisconsin Herd. Nate, tell us a little bit about the NBA and how they use these teams. How many of them are around the country?
I think they're close to having every team sort of has its own affiliate.
Yeah.
And sort of it's kind of based on that effort to launch their own sort of farm club. So it's kind of large part of that larger effort to kind of. For every team to have a minor league club.
What was the process like for choosing Oshkosh to be home to the Herd?
It's a fairly competitive process. They word broke of this back last June, June 2016, and you had five cities that kind of were in the running more or less to host this team. Grand Chute, Sheboygan, La Crosse, and Racine. Kind of over the course of that summer, the Bucks whittled down that list to Racine, Sheboygan, and Oshkosh. And each of these cities kind of submitted a pitch, basically, sort of a plan, kind of what the team would look like, where they would play, what kind of facility they would have. And the Bucks made a determination based on the market, sort of where to place it. But it's a closed door process.
So we don't really know why Oshkosh was chosen over other cities.
No, the main reason, and this kind of came out afterwards, I think, is it's its proximity to other places. The reason why the Bucks were looking to launch a minor league club in Wisconsin, because they could presumably take it anywhere, they could take it to Illinois or something, is that they wanted to expand the Bucks brand throughout the state, essentially. So they placed the team in Oshkosh because of its proximity to Green Bay and Appleton and Fond du Lac, thinking that it would be able to draw fans from the Fox Valley area. And elsewhere, and kind of drum up some excitement about the team outside of the Madison and Milwaukee metro areas.
So this new arena is rising up. How is it changing the neighborhood from a business standpoint?
That was like a great deal, big part of the excitement of having the team there. I mean, it's great for Oshkosh from a tourism perspective because they play in the winter. But it was also seen as a real development boom for the South Side, which has struggled in recent years to deindustrialize and kind of pivot to another industry. So the announcement basically came and sort of has spurred some developers here to invest in the South Side of Oshkosh. There's a new brewery going in down the block. Another team of developers have, opted to remodel another restaurant that had been vacant for 10 years and turn that into, a brew pub and restaurant and then office space. So I think city leaders chiefly are really optimistic that the new arena will anchor a lot of development down here. So.
And there was a bit of pushback for the name The Herd. What do we know about the choice of this name?
Well, I guess they feel like some people were a little disappointed that Oshkosh wasn't in the name, considering that they'd play in Oshkosh. But it kind of ties back to the team's effort to brand their minor league club as kind of a statewide organization, and they want people in Wapaka and Manitowoc to have some ownership of this team too. We had the Oshkosh Flyers, which is another basketball club play back here in the 80s, and Oshkosh isn't in the name, but they'll be playing here.
As we wrap up, how is the Oshkosh community accepting them? Are they embracing them? Is this something people are liking?
Well, I think there's been a great deal of excitement among community leaders, and then people in general are thrilled that this is happening as well. It's something that could help pivot the South Side to more of an entertainment district. It should be, a fun thing to do in the middle of winter, right? So I think people are looking forward to it.
Well, Nate, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you much.
Nate Beck is a business reporter for the Oshkosh Northwestern, and we've been talking about the Wisconsin Herd, the new NBA Development League team that will be based in Oshkosh.
Coming up, we'll look at a new report about CEO compensation. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. The top CEOs make about 271 times the average worker's annual pay. That's according to a report released yesterday by the Economic Policy Institute, a nonpartisan think tank.
The study compared the compensation of CEOs from the largest 350 companies in the U.S. with annual average pay of the typical American worker. The new ratio shows a stark difference between the pay of people in different sectors of the workforce, but is also a slight improvement from last year.
Larry Michel is the president of the Economic Policy Institute and was one of the authors of the report. He holds a doctorate, by the way, from UW-Madison. Larry, welcome to Central Time.
Well, glad to be on with you. Thank you very much.
Well, this latest ratio shows a pretty stark inequality. How bad is it relative to other years?
Well, the CEO compensation in the last couple of years has kind of wobbled. We measure it in two ways because it's a complicated thing. Stock options can be valued according to the value they are when you give it to an executive in a year, or you can judge it by how many of their options they've accumulated and actually kind of cash out in the year. And by one measure, it goes up, by one measure, it goes down. But the bottom line, I think, is what you're having, which is 271 times that of a typical worker is really high, and especially when you compare it to 1965, when it was only 20 times that of a typical worker. So it's hard to believe that CEOs actually need to make 271 times a typical worker to get out of the morning and do a good job.
So is the problem that CEOs are making too much, or are workers making too little, or a bit of both?
Well, it's a bit of both, and they're actually related. I mean, one of the things that our research has showed us, and I think is evident, is that executive pay has escalated. Executive pay is responsible for about 40% of the growth of the top 1% income share, doubling over the last generation. So I think people are aware that top 1% incomes have grown a lot. The single largest reason for that is the growth of executive pay led by CEOs. Now, the thing is that this growth in executive pay does not correspond to the fact that executives are making their firms more productive. It hasn't increased the pie. If you believe that, as I do from the research, then the amount of extra money that all these executives are getting in the top 1% is resources that would be distributed to those in the bottom 99% or 90%. So, in a sense, it is at the expense of the vast majority.
So, can we name names here? Can you give an example of a CEO that is making roughly 271 times more than a typical worker?
Well, that's on average for 350 executives. I don't have the names in front of me now, but they're all the companies that you're familiar with. And we look at the major companies because that's the people whose pay really sets the standard for what all executives get paid, what in their firms, in smaller firms. You can imagine that the pay of the executives of big universities have escalated in part because they're following the pattern set by executive pay in large firms. The pay in large nonprofit hospitals or private hospitals have escalated over the years. So what's happening is when the executive CEO pay goes up, it really pulls on a lot of other people's pay to really grow. And over this time period that we've focused on the most, between 1978 and now, the annual compensation of a typical worker grew only 11%. That's not very much over 40 years. So, that's the major problem, I think, confronting America, is that the wages and benefits of typical Americans have barely grown for many, many decades. The only time they really grew strongly was in the late 1990s.
Talking right now with Larry Mischel. He is the president of the Economic Policy Institute, one of the authors of a new report that found that the nation's top CEOs make 271 times the average annual pay of the typical worker. Larry, companies have to compete for the top talent and keep their CEOs happy so they don't get poached or the CEO doesn't look elsewhere. Isn't it hard to control this marketplace of CEO pay when companies are trying to recruit and retain top talent?
Well, I think you're that is something that is frequently discussed, that this pay just is associated with the market for talent. We look at what's happened to the wages of people who are in the top 0.1% of wage earners, the top 1,000. Those are pretty skilled people.
Yeah.
CEO pay has grown about three times faster than the really large amount that the wages of the top 0.1% grew, which was about 300% over the last 40 years. So it's hard to understand why the market for talent for CEOs is, three multiples of that of those of the top 0.1%. Why CEO compensation grew, 70% more than stock prices, far more than corporate profits. It's hard to justify based on the market for talent. And there's lots of people who set executive pay will tell you what goes on. It's a Lake Wobegon world. Everyone is above average. Every firm believes that its executive should be paid at the 75th percentile, more than the typical executive, right? So more than 75% of the rest of executives, less than 25% of executives. If you do that, then everybody just ratchets up. The other thing is that people, the compensation is tied to the stock market.
Mm.
So if you are tied to the stock market, that may seem like you're being paid for your performance. But when the stock market goes up for every industry. Executives are not paid according to how much the price, the stock of their firm goes up relative to other firms in their industry. It's relative to all firms that are that sell, you know, stock to the public. So basically, when you have a stock market boom, CEO pay will boom.
Yeah.
And that's not because the firms are necessarily more productive. It's because the stock market boom, sometimes for a bubble.
So as you look at this analysis through the decades, has it been a steady escalation or have there been spikes relative to the stock market?
That's a good question. The it really escalated tremendously in the 1990s. And, you know, CEO compensation actually peaked around 2000 at the height of the what you might call the tech bubble.
Tech boom, yeah.
It recovered. You know, it falls when the stock market falls, as it did in the early 2000s and during the Great Recession. But, you know, it's recovered quite a lot, not as much as to 2000. So CEO compensation actually is less now than it was in 2000. But 2000 was a temporary escalated peak because of the tech stock bubble.
So when you did the study, how do you find the, quote, typical American employee?
Good question. What we do is we use data on firms and what their CEOs are paid. And each firm is assigned a major industry. And we know from the Bureau of Labor Statistics what is the annual wages paid to a typical worker in that industry. We technically are using something called the production non-supervisory workers. It tends to be non-managerial workers in the industry, represents about 80% of the workforce. So we're looking at their annual wages and including benefits. We make it compensation, so we're comparing a CEO compensation to the typical worker in their major industry.
Shouldn't shareholders be wary of their executive pay packages because they won't want to burn through too much cash and perks? Do you see company shareholders having enough say on how much executives are paid?
Well, you know, it's not really set up for shareholders to have much say. Mm. They do have some ability to vote against CEO pay packages, but they can't really determine them. And, you know, most of the shareholders are I scratch your back, you scratch mine kind of situation. The mutual funds own a lot of the stock. Most people don't participate in the governance of the firms where they may own a little bit of stock. The CEOs have a lot of control over who's on the compensation committee and what they're going to say. You know, the firms hire particular consultants who tell them what to do. I imagine if they come up with the wrong answers, there are other consultants available.
But this measure called Say on Pay was introduced in 2011. Have we still seen a significant decline in the amount of perks that executives have received since?
No, we don't. I mean, there's a lot of other things that, in my view, need to be done. I mean, one of the main reasons we have high executive pay is just that taxes on the very, very well paid have dropped so much. My colleague points to a Fortune magazine article from the early 1960s, which said, why would you pay your CEO $2 million rather than $1 million when the second million primarily goes to the Treasury?
Mm.
You know, that's when we had 90% marginal taxes on very, very high wage income. But that's hasn't been the case since the early 1980s. And so when there's low taxes, it really it aligns the interest of the CEOs to really escalate their pay. And to do that, you know, they're going to squeeze the workers and squeeze communities and do what they feel is necessary to bump up the stock prices and get their pay.
We're talking to Larry Michel, president of the Economic Policy Institute, about a new report that found the nation's top CEOs make 271 times the average annual pay of the typical worker.
Tell us what you think at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Are you surprised by how much CEOs make compared to workers in their industries? Is that something that's true of the company you work at? Or do you work somewhere where there's a smaller difference between executive and employee pay? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
We're continuing the conversation with Larry Michel, president of the Economic Policy Institute, about the stark compensation gap between the top CEOs and the average worker.
You can tell us what you think at 800-642-1234 or over on the Central Time Facebook page. Are you surprised by the CEO to worker compensation ratio, which is 271-1? Tell us if you think the Trump administration's policies will help or hurt the compensation gap. Do you see compensation gaps where you work right now or at a past employer? And should there be a mandated cap on CEO pay? Tell us what you think at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or over on the Central Time Facebook page.
Let's go right to the phones now with John in Janesville. Hi, John.
How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Go ahead.
I'm wondering why they can't make so that if you have a government contract or something, that the CEOs can't make more than 10 times the amount as the normal wage person. So if somebody's making 10 an hour, the CEO would make $100 an hour. If they wanted more than 100 an hour, they'd have to raise the pay to their workers too. I think it'd be more fair if they did that. Why couldn't the country make a ruling on that?
Larry, do we see a model of this going on anywhere?
Well, John has a good point. There actually was some legislation as part of the healthcare reform in 2010 that limited some of the executive pay in of hospitals in the healthcare sector, and there was an effort to change that this year. But as everyone knows, that's been defeated. And you can have rules for federal contractors. You know, there were rules that put in place. President Obama required companies to pay at least a $10.10 minimum wage for federal contractors. There were also rules about transparency of employment contracts. They outlawed forced arbitration agreements in contracts of federal contractors. All the kind of requirements on federal contractors, including that they revealed their violations of minimum wage laws or overtime laws and safety and health that there were being, you know, alleged or found. All those kind of requirements on federal contractors were eliminated by the Republicans in the new Congress and by President Trump. So it's certainly going to be hard to put on new requirements on federal contractors like this, but they're you know, that is obviously something that can be done. One of the things I should mention is that the Dodd-Frank bill in 2010 did establish that companies have to report the ratio of CEO compensation to the typical worker in their firm, and next year will be the first year that this will be required for them to report. Now, of course, Republican Congress is trying to eliminate Dodd-Frank. The House of Representatives has already voted to do that. And so if that is successful, then that reporting requirement will not ever take place. But it would be a useful thing, and it would inform shareholders and workers of what's the situation in their firm.
Well, John, thanks for calling in. And let's talk further about the Trump administration with Nikki in East Troy. Go ahead, Nikki.
Hi, thank you. And this is what I think, in my opinion, again, with the Trump administration, we know that their biggest thing is raising taxes for the middle class, the lower class, and cutting the taxes for those that make a higher wage. I don't know. I don't see. I don't understand. People think that this is a fair gain. It's a loss for all of us workers who are busting our butts 40 hours, 80 hours a week sometimes, just to try to make a living. And half the time we still can't. So we work two jobs and it's more taxes taken out. We can't, you know, with the taxes taken out, the lower wage, we can't afford everything on top of bills, healthcare, and all these other issues. But those who make a higher wage, they have an easy path and I don't understand how. And it's harder for us to get there because we don't make enough money to pay for school that they might have had or to even get the experience because some of us aren't given chances to even, you know, climb that corporate ladder, I guess.
Well, and Nikki, thank you so much for raising that point of a growing widening divide, economic divide. And it's hard not to notice that President Trump's cabinet consists of millionaires and billionaires, the richest cabinet in history. How could the policies of the Trump administration affect the gap?
Well, there certainly are no plans to do anything to address this. And, you know, you can imagine that the people in power are, you know, very sympathetic to, you know, the executive class. So I don't expect we're going to do something. And in fact, you know, we're about to start having a huge debate on tax policy. And there's an effort to cut taxes on corporations and cut taxes on the wealthy, which will come at the expense of, well, maybe taxes on the middle, as the caller said, or at the expense of health care or Social Security eventually, or other domestic spending. Because if you can't just, you know, not have revenue and think that everything else stays the same.
So what should happen in order to fix this gap? What would you recommend?
Well, I think, one, we need much higher tax rates on those people at the very top. I think we should make it that the performance pay of CEOs, this is mostly the stock options, are not tax deductible. There was an effort in the early 90s to limit the tax deductibility of CEO salary, their wages. Anything above $1 million is not tax deductible to the corporation, but they exempted incentive pay and performance and stock options. So we should eliminate that. You know, we need to do other measures that strengthen corporate governance. And I like the idea of what the caller said. Maybe rules for federal contractors. That's a good one.
Well, really quickly, and Nikki, thanks so much for calling in. Let's go to Scott quickly in Wisconsin Dells. Hi, Scott. Go ahead.
Hello, yes. Well, I'm just calling. I'm in my late 60s, and I just wanted to talk about a company I'd worked for in the early 80s is when I started there. I had changed jobs and went to work there as a tradesman, as a tool and die maker. And I spent 15 years there. But their philosophy was such a family-orientated philosophy, and the owner was ever-present. But what they offered the people is not just a profit sharing, but they had a pension, and there was 125 to 150 people. And the owner was definitely known by just about all.
And I'm going to have to stop you there, Scott, so we can get Larry to respond to family-owned businesses. Is there any moderation of compensation very quickly?
Well, it's hard to know because they're usually privately held. But, you know, I think it's very important that firms establish a, you know, community where everyone feels they're pulling together and everyone will benefit. And in America over the last 40 years, you know, any sense of that is really gone for most of the workforce and most companies. It's mostly, you know, a worship of anything you can do to cut costs and raise profits is a good thing to do.
And we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much.
That was Larry Michel, president of the Economic Policy Institute, joining us to talk about a new study that found the nation's top CEOs make way more than the average annual compensation of typical workers.